This is Democracy Now!
The team meets this moment. This team, behind me. They embody my core beliefs that America is strongest when it works with its allies.
President-elect Joe Biden has introduced key members of his national security team with a vow to re-embrace a multilateral approach and a clear rejection of Trump's America First foreign policy.
My fellow career diplomats and public servants around the world, I want to say to you, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back.
We'll look at Biden's cabinet picks with Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, Professor Barbara Ransby, and former Bernie Sanders speechwriter David Sirota. Then we'll look at the indigenous-led fight against the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline in northern Minnesota. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has just granted a key permit, but protests continue. We'll speak to indigenous lawyer and activist Tara Hauska. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States reported nearly 173,000 new COVID-19 cases and over 2,100 deaths on Tuesday alone, the deadliest day in more than 6 months. Hospitalizations are at an all-time high at nearly 90,000. The U.S. death toll is now approaching 260,000. In California, COVID-19 hospitalizations have gone up over 80% in the past 2 weeks, with ICU hospitalizations increasing by over 50%. Much of California imposed a curfew over the weekend in hopes of slowing a surge that health officials fear will only get worse due to Thanksgiving travel and gatherings. 11 states, many in the Midwest, have recorded more deaths in the past week than in any other week since the pandemic began. The White House Coronavirus Task Force said Tuesday 6.4 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine will be distributed across the country by mid-December, with frontline healthcare workers receiving the first doses. The vaccine was found to be 95% effective in trials, though it must still undergo a final authorization before widespread usage. In international news, the French President Emmanuel Macron announced the country's second wave had passed and he would start to ease lockdown measures, though bars and restaurants will remain closed for at least another 2 months. France has registered the fourth highest number of infections since the pandemic started, behind Brazil, India and the United States. Meanwhile, in neighboring Italy, officials reported over 850 deaths Tuesday, the highest daily toll since the height of the first wave of the pandemic in March. Spain also recorded its highest death toll since the start of its second wave, with over 530 deaths. In medical news, Russia says its Sputnik vaccine is over 95% effective in trials. Countries including Saudi Arabia, the Philippines, Brazil, and India have expressed interest in acquiring the vaccine, though some health experts warn more extensive testing is needed. President-elect Joe Biden has formally introduced part of his national security team. On Tuesday, Biden spoke in Wilmington, Delaware, alongside Secretary of State nominee Tony Blinken, National Intelligence Director nominee Avril Haines, Homeland Security Secretary nominee Alejandro Mayorkas, National Security Advisor nominee Jake Sullivan, and UN Ambassador nominee Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who vowed to embrace multilateralism.
My fellow career diplomats and public servants around the world, I want to say to you, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back.
Biden's special envoy for climate, John Kerry, also spoke.
To end this crisis, the whole world must come together. You're right to rejoin Paris on day one. And you're right to recognize that Paris alone is not enough.
Biden has yet to decide on several key posts in his national security team, including defense secretary and CIA director. We'll have more on Biden's cabinet picks after headlines. While the formal transition has begun, President Trump is still refusing to concede the election. On Tuesday, Trump gave a roughly one-minute news briefing at the White House, where he boasted about the Dow Jones Industrial Average topping 30,000, but took no questions and made no reference to the election. While Trump took credit for the Dow, many economists say stock prices spiked due to reports that Biden would tap former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen to be Treasury Secretary. In the latest blow to Trump's effort to overturn the election, the states of Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Minnesota certified Biden's victory Tuesday. Trump and his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, are expected to travel to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania today to meet with Republican state lawmakers who are holding an unofficial hearing about allegations of voter fraud at a hotel. In the Civil War, Gettysburg was the site of a major Confederate defeat that marked a turning point in the fall of the Confederacy. In Afghanistan, at least 14 people were killed and scores injured in twin explosions in the city of Bamiyan in central Afghanistan. Children were among the victims. Nearly 6,000 Afghan civilians were killed or wounded in the first 9 months of 2020, according to the United Nations. This latest deadly attack came as a major UN donor meeting was held in Geneva, where up to $12 billion in civilian aid over the next 4 years was pledged, though much of its conditional on the success of ongoing peace talks. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres decried the ongoing violence in Afghanistan and called for an immediate ceasefire.
The Afghan people have suffered for far too long. I urge the redoubling of efforts towards an immediate and conditional ceasefire in order to save lives and prevent the further spread of COVID-19. This will create a conducive environment for the Afghanistan peace negotiations in Doha.
Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, is rejecting international calls to a halt a planned attack on the northern Ethiopian city of Mekelle, the capital of the semi-autonomous region of Tigray. Ahmed has threatened to launch the attack today if the Tigray People's Liberation Front did not agree to surrender. Meanwhile, the government-backed Ethiopian Human Rights Commission is accusing a youth group in Tigray of killing at least 600 civilians near the Sudanese border earlier this month. The report has not been independently verified. In Paris, crowds gathered Tuesday evening to protest the violent clearing of a refugee camp at the Place de la République on Monday. Images of police forcing people out of tents, throwing them to the ground, tear gassing and chasing them in the street have rocked France, with Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo calling it a, quote, denial of France's humanitarian duty and triggering an official probe by the public prosecutor. Journalists also say they were attacked. The shocking scenes come as France is debating passage of a new law that would increase police powers and criminalize the publication of images of on-duty police. The law recently passed a vote in the National Assembly and will go before the Senate next month. At least four asylum seekers were killed when their boat capsized Tuesday off the coast of Lanzarote in the Canary Islands. 28 survivors were rescued. It's the latest tragedy to occur on the perilous route from West Africa to the Canary Islands, which have become a flashpoint in the ongoing refugee crisis, as the number of people arriving to the Spanish archipelago by sea has increased more than tenfold over last year. Last month, 140 people drowned off the coast of Senegal after their boat caught fire en route to the Canary Islands. Spain said last week it would help set up temporary camps for 7,000 asylum seekers. Back in the United States, President Trump's reportedly planning to pardon his former national security adviser Michael Flynn and others before he leaves office. Flynn has twice pleaded guilty in court to lying to the FBI about his communications with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. in 2016. Talk of the pardons came after President Trump made one of his rare public appearances after the election when he pardoned a turkey for Thanksgiving. California Senator Dianne Feinstein is stepping down as the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Feinstein faced intense backlash last month after over her weak performance during the confirmation proceedings for Justice Amy Coney Barrett. She has also drawn ire among climate activists after a widely circulated video in which she disparaged young children asking her to support the Green New Deal. The Sunrise Movement said in response to the news that Feinstein should not just step down, but resign to make way for a progressive California lawmaker who supports the Green New Deal. In immigration news, the U.S. government's agreed to temporarily stall the deportation of immigrant women who say they may have undergone invasive gynecological procedures, including forced sterilizations, while imprisoned at the Irwin Detention Center in Georgia. A letter by over 100 Democratic lawmakers issued earlier this month says at least six survivors have reportedly been deported. Several others faced imminent deportation as dozens of people were complaining about what took place. To watch our interview with Jaramí Floriano Navarro, a survivor who was deported to Mexico, go to democracynow.org. In related news, immigration advocates are condemning officials in Hudson County, New Jersey, for approving a new 10-year jail contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. More than 75 people spoke out against the contract renewal at a 10-hour public meeting Tuesday. Despite overwhelming opposition, the all-Democratic board still approved the deal. In Montana, two U.S. citizens who were apprehended by Customs and Border Protection for speaking Spanish while grocery shopping have reached a settlement in their racial profiling lawsuit against the Trump administration. Ana Suda and Marta Hernandez were standing in line at the store when a CBP agent asked them where they were born and demanded to see identification after hearing them speak Spanish. The two women, who were born in Texas and California, showed their valid Montana driver's licenses, but were taken into custody anyway. In more immigration news, BuzzFeed reports the Trump administration deported 33 unaccompanied children to Guatemala just minutes after a judge last week blocked a policy that allowed immigration officials to quickly expel refugee children and asylum seekers without the due process by citing the coronavirus pandemic. Since ICE violated the judge's ruling, the agency could be forced to bring the 33 children back. Some 13,000 unaccompanied refugee children have been deported since March under the policy. Meanwhile, a new federal court filing shows CBP held over 60 children, including infants under the age of one, at facilities at the U.S.-Mexico border for over 3 days in the past 2 months, a violation of the Flores Agreement. Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, pleaded guilty to three criminal charges, admitting responsibility for its role in fueling the devastating opioid epidemic that's killed hundreds of thousands of people. The charges included offering illegal kickbacks to doctors in exchange for them writing more prescriptions. Purdue reached a plea deal with the Justice Department for over $8 billion last month, but will likely pay out just a fraction of that as the company's in bankruptcy proceedings. Members of the billionaire Sackler family, who own Purdue, have not been criminally charged. And Scotland's become the first country in the world to make menstrual products free and easy to access. Lawmakers approved the landmark bill Tuesday, which aims to end period poverty by ensuring tampons and pads be available for free in schools and other public buildings. This is Monica Lennon, the lawmaker who introduced the bill, speaking ahead of the vote.
The thought of anyone having to go to a food bank for foods, toiletries and essential period products remains unacceptable, and we have huge work to do to address wealth inequalities in our society. The impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on public health and on incomes only makes the case for this bill even stronger. Periods don't stop for pandemics.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with my co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President-elect Joe Biden has introduced key members of his national security team with a vow to re-embrace the world and a clear rejection of America, of Trump's America First foreign policy.
The team meets this moment. This team, behind me, they embody my core beliefs that America is strongest when it works with its allies.
The president-elect spoke Wednesday in Wilmington, Delaware, alongside several members of his future cabinet, including Secretary of State nominee Tony Blinken, National Intelligence Director nominee Avril Haines, National Security Advisor nominee Jake Sullivan, Secretary of Homeland Security nominee Alejandro Mayorkas, and UN Ambassador nominee Linda Thomas-Greenfield. We'll hear more about them in our next segment. But first, we turn to look at a member of Biden's national security team who has not yet been announced. We don't know who his pick for the Secretary of Defense will be. Several media outlets have reported Biden planned to nominate Michelle Flournoy, but progressives, including some lawmakers, are speaking out in opposition. If nominated and confirmed, Flournoy would become the first woman in the post. She served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Obama administration from 2009 to 2012. After she left, she founded the consultancy firm West Exec Advisors with Tony Blinken, now the Secretary of State nominee. The secretive consulting firm, with the motto "Bringing the Situation Room to the Boardroom," has many former Obama administration officials on staff, including former CIA Deputy Director Avril Haines, who helped design Obama's drone program, is now Biden's pick for Director of National Intelligence. California Congressmember Ro Khanna tweeted, quote, "Flournoy supported the war in Iraq and Libya, criticized Obama and Syria, and helped craft the surge in Afghanistan. I want to support the president's picks, but will Flournoy now commit to a full withdrawal from Afghanistan and a ban on arms sales to the Saudis to end the Yemen war?" Ro Khanna asked. Meanwhile, Code Pink's Medea Benjamin tweeted, quote, "If Biden puts her name forward, anti-war activists should quickly launch an all-out effort to block Senate confirmation. Hashtag feminism, not militarism." Well, Medea Benjamin joins us right now. She is co-founder of Code Pink, author of a number of books, including Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. Her latest book, Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Medea, welcome back to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're going to talk about President-elect Biden's picks. This is a person who has not yet been named, extremely important position, the Secretary of Defense. Can you talk about your concerns and what's going on behind the scenes, both in the grassroots community and among progressive lawmakers?
Flournoy, yet it shows that there is some division within Biden's people on this right now. She represents the epitome of what is worst about the Washington blob, the military-industrial complex's revolving door. Her whole history has been one of going in and out of the Pentagon, first under President Clinton, then under President Obama, where she supported every war that the U.S. engaged in and supported increases in the military budget, and then used her contacts in government in these kind of hawkish think tanks that she either joined or helped create. She sits on the board of a corporation that works with defense contractors. She herself has made a lot of money by parlaying these insider contacts into positioning companies to be able to get these very plush Pentagon contracts. She also sees China as an enemy that has to be confronted with higher tech weapons, which justifies increased Pentagon spending and puts us on a dangerous path of an increased Cold War with China. So these are just some of the reasons we think she would be a disastrous pick as Secretary of Defense.
Well, Medea, she not only worked in the Defense Department under the, Obama, she also worked in the Defense Department under Bill Clinton and was rumored to be Hillary Clinton's first choice as Secretary of Defense had Hillary won the election in 2016. So she definitely is, as you say, part of this establishment of the military-industrial complex going way back. But could you talk about this West Exec Advisors that she helped to create? And we already have two people from that consultancy, that strategic advisory consultancy named by Biden. She would be the third if she was chosen. What has been the role of this barely known group outside of Washington?
Well, that's right. And that's why it's so important to look at this West Exec Advisors, first of all, to understand that it's a secret organization. Reveal who its clients are. But we do know that it has been working with Israeli companies. It seems that they work with the United Arab Emirates. And they their job is to get contracts for the Pentagon from companies, including companies from Silicon Valley. This is the worst of Washington. Yes, he's already picked Anthony Blinken, who was the co-founder with Michelle Flournoy. Bad enough that they brought in April Haynes, who is part of West Exec Advisors. But this consulting firm that seems to be Biden's government in waiting represents the kind of Washington insider revolving door. Make sure that companies are have an easy in into the Pentagon, and using these insiders from both the Bill Clinton years and the Obama years, and especially the Obama years, to grease the wheels for those companies. So, unfortunately, we would like to know more about West Exec Advisors, but is, as I say, a company that won't reveal who its clients are.
Reading from an article, the website for West Exec Advisors includes a map depicting West Executive Avenue, the secure road on the White House grounds between the West Wing and the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, as a way to show what the consulting firm can do for its clients. Quite literally, the road to the Situation Room and the road everyone associated with West Exec Advisors has crossed many times en route to meetings of the highest national security consequences. Medea, your piece in Common Dreams is headlined, "Will Michelle Flournoy Be the Angel of Death for the American Empire?" What do you mean?
Well, I feel that we can go one of two ways. We continue on this route of trying to pretend that the U.S. has the right and the ability to dictate what the world should look like, which is Michelle Flournoy's worldview. Or Biden could go the other way, which is to understand that the U.S. is an empire in crisis, needs to take care of its problems here at home, like this pandemic, and has to decrease the enormous military budget that is eating up over half of our discretionary funds. And if he picks Michelle Flournoy, I think we will continue on that road of the declining empire, which will be terrible for us in the United States, because it will mean that we'll continue these wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, U.S. involvement in Syria, but also at the same time try to pivot to China, which we can't possibly keep this empire going and try to deal with all the crises we have here at home.
And Medea, you also write about Michelle Flournoy's involvement with the Center on a New American Security, this think tank that she helped to create. Could you talk about what that's produced and what she did there?
Well, that is seen as one of the most hawkish think tanks, and it is one of the most well-funded by precisely government and military contractors, as well as oil companies. So it is an example that she started herself of leaving the administration from the Pentagon, using her Rolodex to create this think tank and get it funded by the very companies that she dealt with when she was inside the Pentagon.
We're going to break now. We want to thank you, Medea Benjamin, for joining us, co-founder of the peace organization Code Pink, author of a number of books, including Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. We'll be joined by Bernie Sanders' former speechwriter, David Sirota, as well as Professor Barbara Ransby, to look at who was on the stage in Wilmington, Delaware, the choices that President-elect Biden has made so far. Stay with us.
Lies that travel faster than the truth. All it in isn't that how the man do. Never can I catch your face. No solid ground, no near have I come. Lies travel faster than the truth.
Chinese wall, whispers cast to make an empty future call. Longitude, latitude, what I have been. No harness, this beast. I don't need to get back on leash. Gratitude you gave, I didn't ask for this. When you can't have, you want on. You don't need to ask.
Faster Than the Truth by Nena Cherry. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to look at how progressive movements are responding to the cabinet president, to the cabinet that President-elect Joe Biden's assembling as he names a number of establishment figures to key posts. Biden named longtime advisor Tony Blinken as incoming Secretary of State. Blinken previously served as Deputy Secretary of State for President Obama. He spoke Tuesday after his nomination was announced on the stage in Wilmington, Delaware, socially distanced from each of the other nominees, telling the story of how his stepfather was the only one of 900 children at his school in Bialystok, Poland, to survive the Holocaust at the end of the war.
At the end of the war, he made a break from a death march into the woods in Bavaria. From his hiding place, he heard a deep rumbling sound. It was a tank. But instead of the Iron Cross, he saw painted on its side a five-pointed white star. He ran to the tank. The hatch opened. An African-American GI looked down at him. He got down on his knees and said the only three words that he knew in English that his mother had taught him before the war. God bless America.
Tony Blinken grew up both in New York and in Paris with his mother and stepfather. He speaks fluent French. That was Biden's pick for Secretary of State. The president-elect has also named Linda Thomas-Greenfield, a 35-year veteran of the Foreign Service, as the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Thomas-Greenfield was an ambassador to Liberia, an assistant secretary of state for African affairs under Obama. She was fired days into the Trump administration. Linda Thomas-Greenfield's last job was with Albright Stonebridge Group, which was co-founded by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. This is Thomas-Greenfield speaking Tuesday.
On this day, I'm thinking about the American people, my fellow career diplomats and public servants around the world. I want to say to you, America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back. Mr. President-elect, I've often heard you say how all politics is personal, and that's how you build relationships of trust and bridge disagreements and find common ground. And in my 35 years in the Foreign Service across four continents, I put a Cajun spin on it. I called it gumbo diplomacy. Wherever I was posted around the world, I'd invite people of different backgrounds and beliefs to help me make a roux and chop onions for the Holy Trinity and make homemade gumbo. It was my way of breaking down barriers, connecting with people, and starting to see each other on a human level.
That was Linda Thomas-Greenfield, President-elect Biden's pick to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She was born in Louisiana. She talked about gumbo rather than gunboat diplomacy. Former Secretary of State and presidential candidate John Kerry will serve as Biden's special climate envoy. He also spoke in Delaware yesterday.
Mr. President-elect, you've put forward a bold, transformative climate plan. But you've also underscored that no country alone can solve this challenge. Even the United States, for all of our industrial strength, is responsible for only 13% of global emissions. To end this crisis, the whole world must come together. You're right to rejoin Paris on day one. And you're right to recognize that Paris alone is not enough.
but John Kerry would serve on the National Security Council as the newly created position of climate envoy. For more on President-elect Biden's new team, we're joined by two guests, Professor Barbara Ransby, historian, author and activist, advisor to the Movement for Black Lives, professor of African-American studies, gender and women's studies and history at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She is joining us from Chicago. And in Denver, Colorado, David Sirota is with us, an investigative journalist, founder of the news website The Daily Poster. He served as an advisor and speechwriter for Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Ransby, let's begin with you. So you had that scene yesterday in Wilmington, Delaware. All of the nominees came out on the stage with President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. All were masked. All stood 6 feet from each other. And after each person spoke, someone came out and wiped down the podium. But Barbara Ransby, the substance of who has been chosen, the beginning of the cabinet, particularly on national security and foreign policy, your thoughts?
Well, thank you again for having me, Amy, and for the good work that you do every day. So, yeah, I saw that press conference, too, and I'm certainly glad that they're following the CDC protocols for social distancing. But as you say, it's the substance of those appointments that really should concern us. And I think listening to Medea Benjamin a few minutes ago talk about this West exec advisors that Blinken and Haynes are a part of or were a part of, you know, to look at the absence of some prominent progressives who could have filled some of these positions, people like, say, a Sarah Nelson from the Flight Attendants Union, strong advocate for labor and working people, people who have been international solidarity activists certainly could have filled the position of ambassador to the United Nations. So it is of concern. I think it's an extension of what we've been hearing from some of the centrist Democrats about the left as being divisive, the need to reach across the aisle. Look, progressives, black people helped to put Joe Biden in office. It certainly wasn't his, you know, stellar record as a candidate or his, you know, eloquence or anything else. So that has to be taken into consideration. And look, we need people who have competence, but we need people who have compassion, who have accountability to the most vulnerable, who pledge to defend the planet, people who have a clear understanding and commitment to fighting white supremacy and police violence. So I don't see that in this group, and it concerns me. And I'll say this, what concerns me also is the presentation of this as a cabinet of firsts. Jake Sullivan is the youngest. Avril Haines is the first woman in the position she's appointed to, et cetera. You know, I don't necessarily just want people that look like me. I want people who are really going to make a difference and who are accountable to the communities that that I'm committed to, that I come from, that progressive organizers have been working to empower. So, you know, we've seen diversity, and diversity is fine. It's necessary. I certainly don't want to see an all-white male cabinet. But it is woefully insufficient. We see that time and again. We see it with Barack Obama's administration. This kind of looks like Obama 2.0 in some respects. And we see it, you know, with Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court and a whole list and litany of public officials who offer cosmetic change but not substantive change. We are in a deep and disturbing set of crises, and we need people who are going to act to curb the greed of billionaires and provide relief to working people. But we also need people who are going to speak out and stand up against racism and the resurgence of white nationalism. I'm not confident that Biden is heading in that direction, which is why we need to continue to build a movement.
Well, Barbara Ransby, I wanted to ask you about one person who's being talked about who has not yet been named, but could be someone that you whose record you know well as a Chicagoan. That's Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, who is being talked about, has been mentioned as a possible secretary of transportation. I'm wondering your thoughts on that and whether that would be a further mistake by the president-elect. And also that Rahm Emanuel, since he left office has gone back into the corporate world in terms of advising companies on mergers and acquisitions.
Right. Well, I think you probably know my answer to that one. You know, Chicagoans, the Chicago movement would be in the street if Rahm Emanuel was nominated to a cabinet position. Not only the commitment to corporate interests, but the cover-up, the inexcusable cover-up of Laquan McDonnell murder, a young black man murdered by police and Rahm Emanuel, by all indications, participating in a cover-up of that murder. Closing schools in black and brown neighborhoods, closing mental health centers, having a deaf ear to the demands of progressives in this city. So, we wouldn't support that. That would be a slap in the face to progressives, not just in Chicago, but around this country. So, another Chicagoan who would be quite an alternative to Rahm Emanuel is Congressman Chuy Garcia, who comes out of our movements, has a progressive record. So his name has been floated for the transportation post, and certainly that would be a welcome divergence from a Rahm Emanuel type appointment.
And David Sirota, if you can weigh in on those who have been chosen. I mean, you have Alejandro Mayorkas, who would be the first Latinx head or secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. He talked about his family. He put it as fleeing communism, fleeing Cuba, and coming to this country. You have, Professor Ransby just talked about, among those, April Haynes and the climate envoy, John Kerry, a new position that clearly President-elect Biden has chosen to say climate change will be front and center.
Well, look, the nominees as a whole, I think, represent an effort at restoration, the idea being that we have to bring back familiar faces, Washington careerists, to restore the pre-Trump Washington status quo. And typically, these are people with various corporate ties, ties to the establishment, ties to corporate power. John Kerry is a good example, and it's not to pick him out and say, you know, he's particularly bad or particularly awful, but here's a guy who was in government. When he was in government, he was very supportive of fossil fuel development, fracking in particular. He left office. He then got a top position at Bank of America, which is one of the largest financiers of fossil fuel development in the world. And then he comes back into government as the Biden's, at least first, climate pick. And it's not to say that John Kerry is going to be terrible on climate, but it is to say, as one example of many, that we need to understand where these people come from. Joe Biden on the campaign on climate on climate policy, his campaign very early on said it was seeking a, quote, middle ground on climate policy. And so I think what you see in all of these nominees, and you can go through all of them, is that it is an attempt to restore the old Washington. It is ideologically, these are middle ground picks. And what that says to me is that it's going to be more important than ever for movements, activists, people all over this country to demand the kinds of policies that Joe Biden at least rhetorically promised on the campaign, that the personnel that Joe Biden is appointing so far are not people who are going to necessarily do the right thing on their own. They are not necessarily people who are going to offer a different kind of path, one that doesn't appease corporate interests. They're not going to do that alone unless they are actually pushed and pressured. And that's going to be the key.
And David, I wanted to ask you about you were a speechwriter for Bernie Sanders. Clearly, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren represented to some degree the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party. There's still talk of Bernie Sanders as possible labor secretary, but clearly Elizabeth Warren is not going to get any kind of a major position, it appears at this point in the Biden administration. Your sense of how they might still be able to influence these choices, and also the argument that Biden may be trying to figure out who he can name that will get confirmation from a Senate that will could be in Republican hands, but certainly will be very divided.
Well, look, I think we need to remember that lawmakers themselves can be independent power centers, that there was a time in this country when there were the so-called giants of the Senate. And I think people like Bernie Sanders, people like Elizabeth Warren, fit that archetype, or at least potentially do, in the sense that they have they're well known in the country. They have a large mass movement followings among them, a very large grassroots a set of grassroots supporters. And they can choose to use that power in the Senate on legislation and on nominations. I mean, the other way to look at nominations, if we're just talking about cabinet nominations, is the progressives in the Senate are also could be a voting bloc. If the Republicans are going to oppose Joe Biden nominees, then it means that a progressive bloc of Senate votes can be the difference between confirmation and not confirmation. And those progressive senators have the potential power to demand progressive cabinet appointees. And we've seen this happen at certain points. In the second term, in Obama's second term, you saw Elizabeth Warren oppose various Obama potential appointees on the grounds that they were too close to Wall Street. And ultimately, those nominees were not confirmed because of that opposition. And we've seen a new poll that's come out that says about 68% of Americans. This is a poll from Demand Progress that just came out yesterday that we reported on at the Daily Poster. 68% of Americans say that if Biden appoints corporate executives or lobbyists to top positions, that 68% of Americans want the Senate to vote those nominees down. So I would say that those progressives, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, others in the Senate, have serious leverage. But the question is always, will they actually use that leverage? Not to pick on them. I think Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have at times used that leverage. But will the progressive movement and progressive legislators in the Congress use the leverage that they have? That's the open question.
Congress members Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, you know, members of what's known as the Squad, are the first sitting members of Congress to sign a petition launched by the Justice Democrats against a potential nomination of Joe Biden's former chief of staff, Bruce Reed, as head of the Office of Management and Budget. Reed's considered a deficit hawk, has supported cuts to Social Security and Medicare. The petition calls for OMB to, quote, be staffed with people who prioritize working people, not Wall Street deficit scaremongers. Let me put this question to Professor Ransby. In the midst of this serious pandemic-fueled recession, is it possible to build back better with Wall Street-friendly austerity politics? And what about these Congress members speaking out and taking a stand, drawing a line in the sand on Reed?
Yeah, well, I think that's a welcome and refreshing move by elected officials. Rashida Tlaib is somebody who is pretty uncompromising in speaking out, so I'm not surprised that she's one of the signatories of the petition opposing Bruce Reed. I mean, we have to be very, very attentive to people being put in positions of power with regard to the economy. And on one hand, this is not surprising. On the other hand, we have to be vigilant. You know, somebody like Derek Hamilton or Stephanie Kelton, people who have bold ideas that really would serve the economic interests of the majority of people, of poor and working people, rather than people who have consulted for corporations, who've been paid by corporations and financial institutions and Wall Street and so forth. So obviously we have to oppose, you know, a Reed nomination. But I think bigger than that, Amy, you know, I wanted to go back to something David Sirota said, which is about the importance of movements continuing to organize. I mean, we have all been so obsessed with this election, so fearful that this, you know, maniac and aspiring dictator would have retained power for four more years, that I don't want us to lose sight of the importance of pressure from the street. We had literally tens of millions of people in the street after the murder of George Floyd. And it wasn't just about the murder of George Floyd. It was about all the George Floyds who struggle in an economy that's not in their interest, who struggle to make ends meet, who are vulnerable to police harassment on the street, partly because of their race and class vulnerabilities. And so we have to fight for people in these positions of power that are going to respond to our demands, but we also have to organize to make those demands as loudly, as persistently as possible. So, you know, the group, the Frontline, which was a coalition to defeat Trump, you know, has called for actions on Inauguration Day in Washington to do exactly that, to push for a progressive agenda. And so we need to be supporting movements like that as well. I mean, we can get a less bad appointment out of Joe Biden in some of these cabinet positions, and that is important. I am all about, you know, increasing the margin of possibility in that arena, but also really about the importance of building a movement in this period and not forgetting, you know, the neoliberal politics of a Joe Biden, who took us into the war in Iraq and supported the crime bill and all of these things that helped to put us in the position we're in now. So there's a lot of work for movement organizers to do. Being attentive to these cabinet posts is one of them, but certainly not the only.
And David Sirota, we only have about a minute or so left, but I wanted to ask you about the speculation on the Department of Justice that Biden could possibly name Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, before that a staff member for Chuck Schumer, as possible head of DOJ or the Securities and Exchange Commission. I'm wondering your thoughts about that.
Well, Preet Bharara got a reputation as being supposedly tough on crime because he prosecuted some insider trading. He investigated part of the Cuomo administration in New York. But we have to remember that the big thing about Preet Bharara. Preet Bharara was the head of the most powerful prosecutorial office in the United States during the financial crisis, the Southern District of New York, as you said, Juan. And in that time, there were no prosecutions of top executives at major banks in relation to the financial crisis. The idea of putting someone in power at the top of the Justice Department who played an active role in making sure that Wall Street executives were not prosecuted after the financial crisis would be a complete abomination. It would be a disturbing promotion of the idea of a lack of accountability. And I'll just say the last thing about all of this, which is that we really are seeing in a lot of ways in this whole debate an effort to pretend that the past crises that we faced, the Iraq War, the financial crisis and the like, didn't happen. Or if they did happen, that the people who helped lead us into that, there will not be accountability for them. There will not even be career accountability or job accountability for them in terms of getting promoted later. So the point about Preet Bharara is if he is put in there, the implications for what we're saying about whether Wall Street will ever be held accountable, whether for the financial crisis in the past or crises in the future, they would be deeply, deeply disturbing.
Sirota, I want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning investigative journalist, founder of the news website, The Daily Poster, columnist for The Guardian, editor-at-large for Jacobin, serves as an advisor and speechwriter for Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. And I want to thank Barbara Ransby, historian, author, and activist advisor to the Movement for Black Lives, professor of African-American Studies, Gender and Women's Studies and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Her latest book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. This is Democracy Now! Next up, we look at the indigenous-led fight against the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline in northern Minnesota. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has just granted a key permit, but protests continue. Stay with us. Thank you. Missing by Iraqi musician Rahim Ahaj. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to Minnesota, where a massive fight against the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline is brewing after the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers approved a permit for the project this week. Pipeline construction is now set to begin by the end of the month, despite years of resistance and the concerns of indigenous communities who say it would violate tribal sovereignty and contaminate land and water. Construction could also bring thousands of temporary workers to Minnesota, even as COVID-19 cases are spiking in the state. The controversial proposed pipeline would carry tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to a terminal in Superior, Wisconsin, cutting through Indigenous territory in Minnesota and running under more than 200 streams. As Native and climate activists prepare to resist the pipeline's construction, they say they fear militarized tactics like those seen at Standing Rock at the mass protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline in 2016. In response to these concerns, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission has forbidden Enbridge from, quote, engaging in counterinsurgency tactics or misinformation campaigns designed to interfere with the public's legal exercise of constitutional rights. But advocates say they've already faced counterinsurgency tactics by the police and private security. For more, we go to Sioux City, Iowa, where we're joined by Tara Hauska, Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the GNU Collective. She is Ojibwe from the Kuchiching First Nation. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tara. Talk about what's happening this week, your concerns about Enbridge, and what the protests are all about.
Yeah, this week we saw the Trump administration do exactly what we thought they would do, which was approve the last final major hurdle for Enbridge to begin construction of Line 3. It's been a long 7-year fight against this particular project in the regulatory process and the legal processes. And we thought maybe that Minnesota, with its Democratic leadership, would do something different. But it turns out they are apparently not as brave as Governor Whitmer over in Michigan and are willing to put our children's futures on the line to allow through a Canadian corporation to do as it wishes and to suppress the rights of our citizens, including surveillance, militarization of law enforcement, direct payments to law enforcement. I mean, that's what's happening on the ground.
And could you talk about Enbridge, the Canadian company, for those of our viewers and listeners who don't know about it?
Yeah, sure. Enbridge is, you know, the largest pipeline infrastructure company in North America. It is a massive company that is directly tied to the continuation and perpetuation of the tar sands industry. Tar sands is the dirtiest fossil fuel in the world. It's pulled out of the ground up in Alberta, Canada. It is one of three projects that I'm working on, the Line 3 project. It's also tied to Keystone XL and the Trans Mountain Pipeline over in British Columbia. Those are the last three major tar sands lines that are proposed. All the others have been canceled due to resistance on the ground, particularly the Indigenous-led resistance. Enbridge has a long history of spills. You know, I mean, it's responsible for the largest inland spill in U.S. history, over in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. So they have a long history of causing pretty serious destructive damage to the environment.
And besides the environmental threat, isn't there also the threat of having hundreds of temporary workers from across the United States in the region in construction during the pandemic, especially given the enormous toll that the pandemic has taken on Indigenous communities?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking numbers in Minnesota that are now 1 in 10. That's how many people are sick in this area. Right next door to us in North Dakota, 1 in 1,000 people have passed away from COVID-19. It's one of the worst places in the entire world that's been hit by this pandemic. And we're already seeing out-of-state plates all over in rural northern Minnesota. We can notice when people are not from the area. It's a small, remote place. You know, that's the communities that are along the line. We're talking some counties with maybe one or two or no ICU beds. It is a situation where you're just kind of throwing a match into an existing pandemic we're talking about Thanksgiving or, you know, Truceiving or whatever it happens to be, depending on how your understanding of it is. But the governor has said you can't gather with your family, but yet they're bringing in, you know, thousands of temporary workers to build this oil pipeline. So where's the actual concern for public health?
And what about the counterinsurgency issues that have been raised?
You know, I mean, I saw that counterinsurgency language. I'm not exactly sure what the Public Utility Commission thinks counterinsurgency is, because we've already been heavily surveilled. We are being heavily surveilled. There's been reports now of Customs Border Patrol drones that we've seen over our encampment on private land. We knew that was happening. There are people that are surveilling and targeting individual citizens, including myself, including others that have been leaders in this particular fight. There's militarization of law enforcement all along the line, purchases of riot gear, bringing in of MRAPs and all kinds of other militarized force. I can only presume it has to do with the Line 3 struggle. The sheriff of Hubbard County, where our encampment is located, about 200 yards off the line, openly accepted a bunch of equipment like bolt cutters and, you know, chains and all that stuff from Enbridge directly with a truckload pulled up to the sheriff's station and admitted to that. Said, yeah, of course we did. It was free. I mean, that's where we're at.
And just last week, as I understand, two water protectors locked themselves to Enbridge Line 3 excavators blocking active construction of pump stations. Could you talk about the ongoing actions of resistance that have been occurring and that you expect will occur?
Yeah, as soon as they started building Line 3 around the state of Minnesota, there was a, you know, encampment that was formed back in 2018 when the line was initially improved by the Public Utility Commission in Minnesota. And so there's been a series of ongoing actions against transmission lines, pump stations, all the pre-construction, which really is, you know, the same type of destructive damage into the wetlands and into these protected places that's now only upticking. I mean, there's hundreds of excavators all over, scattered over northern Minnesota. And in the meantime, there's been hundreds and thousands of people that have been training, preparing, and building community together, recognizing that our freedom and our bodies are something that's going to be needed in this long fight against the fossil fuel industry and against the destruction of our only home.
Tara, your final thoughts on this day before Thanksgiving that you'd like to share with people, and also the push for Deb Haaland, the congressmember from New Mexico, to be the first Native American Secretary of the Interior?
You know, it's a moment where I think a lot of folks are maybe starting to wake up to the idea that those construction paper headdresses and pilgrims and Indian stories really aren't all that we were taught in school. That there were actually a series of massacres and broken promises that have occurred with the onset of colonization, and that it's not quite so rosy as our children are led to believe. And so I hope that we are able to, you know, come together with our families if we are able to be with our families or be together through virtual means or whatever it happens to be, and tell some truth about what the real story is and how we learn from that and move forward together. That includes something like appointing Deb Haaland to the Secretary of the Interior position, overseeing Native affairs. Imagine having a Native person actually overseeing Native affairs for the first time in U.S. history.
Tara Housko, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Indigenous lawyer and activist, founder of the Ginu Collective. She is Ojibwe from the Cochiching First Nation. And tune in tomorrow for our holiday special with Jody Archambault of Standing Rock, Ali Young in Arizona, Bree Newsom and Eddie Glaud, as well as Juan Gonzalez on Latino results from the election. And Friday, we re-air our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.